Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, our contributing editor, Dr. Clarice Rapisarda from University of North Carolina, Charlotte, speaks with her colleague there, Dr. Phyllis Post, a full professor in the Department of Counseling, regarding child-centered play therapy.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Dr. Clarice Rapisarda, and I'm here with Dr. Phyllis Post. Both of us are at UNC Charlotte. And today we're going to be talking about, I think, a wonderful way of working with children through play therapy. And Dr. Phyllis Post is definitely our resident expert here at UNC Charlotte in the Department of Counseling. Phyllis, would you mind just start maybe sharing with us to begin with how you became interested in play therapy and the role that that's evolved for you?
Sure. I became involved with play therapy definitely because of my own personal experiences with my children. I've always been person-centered in my theoretical orientation to counseling, and I was a middle school counselor and got my PhD in 1980, but there were no courses at that time in play therapy or how to work with children specifically. But I was very interested in working with children, have been for a long time. In 1991, I had a daughter, and when I had my child, I became very interested in the work of T. Barry Brazelton. And he had a very child-centered approach to children. And everything I read, I thought, oh, this sounds like a person-centered theoretical base. So I thought there must be an approach like this to doing counseling with young children. And I looked into it. I didn't have to look very far. I just had not been exposed to it at all. But T. Barry Brazelton's approach and what I found to be a counseling approach was the child-centered approach of towards play therapy and the work of Gary Landreth. And I immediately was very attracted to that. And Gary Landreth's theoretical approach was also person-centered, as was Virginia Axelrod. They both were students of the theoretical orientation of Carl Rogers. And so, theoretically, it was just a perfect match for me, and that's how I personally became involved with play therapy. And then it just kind of snowballed. I went to some conferences and got pretty involved with Gary Landreth and did some supervision with him and did his intensive play therapy training down at the University of North Texas. And he's just been an amazing mentor for me, support for me in terms of my work here at UNCC. So now here at UNCC, we now teach two classes in play therapy, and we are about to embark upon a really bigger thing of having a graduate certificate and a Center for Play Therapy here at UNCC. But right now we teach two classes, a basic intro to a play therapy class and a class in working with parents and teachers, a more advanced class in terms of helping train those folks in terms of a way of being young children.
Oh, sounds very exciting.
Yeah, it is.
And so maybe you can just fill us in some of, kind of briefly, of what exactly this approach to play therapy is and how it might differ from some others that are out there.
Sure. Child-centered play therapy, as I said, is really theoretically based on a person-centered approach to counseling. And play therapy assumes that toys are the way children most naturally communicate. And if we're going to help children, we need to work with them in the medium that is most natural for them to work in. So toys are to children as words are to grown-ups. And play is the language of children. So that is the idea. Now, when you think of that theoretical base, the idea of child-centered play therapy basically is that we believe that given the right environment, an environment of acceptance, of trust, showing you care, showing you understand, in that environment, a child is freed to naturally deal with his or her problems in the way that he or she needs to deal with their problems. We trust the child. We believe that all human beings have an intrinsic drive to grow and to heal and to change. And child-centered play therapy creates that environment, tries to create the perfect environment for the child so that they can do what they need to do to reach their own personal potential. But it's not, as opposed to other approaches to both counseling adults and counseling children, we allow the children to make decisions about what they do in the therapy time rather than us making decisions for them, which would be a more directive approach to play therapy. I don't know if that captures that or not. Maybe that's enough on that. But.
Yeah, I think so. And knowing that this is a, you know, its own specialized area, as you had shared with us with some of, with your extensive training and background. Mm-hmm. Maybe along those lines, talk with us a little about what some of the maybe key techniques are or key skills that a clinician that or counselor that was wanting to use this would be using.
Sure. I think one thing that I think about a lot is child-centered play therapy, even though when the child goes into the play therapy room, they are free to play with the toys in any way they choose to play with the toys, even though we do set limits. The truth is that we are very consistent and very structured about our way of being in the playroom. And I think that's a wonderful thing for the child. They can count on us. It's going to be the same every time. We're going to sit in the same place, and we're going to introduce the session in the same way, and we will provide for them a basic structure that says, I hear you, I am here, I care about you, and I understand you. And then the child moves around in that. But before I tell you some skills, let me tell you that we are very careful about what we put in the playroom. We don't collect toys. We select toys. Mm. And we select toys from three different dimensions. The first is real-life toys. The child has a wide variety of toys like trucks and cars and hospital kits and a dollhouse and doll figures with different skin tones and a kitchen with dishes and plates and money, a cash register. That's one category. Another category of toys is aggressive release toys, and those would be toys like handcuffs, a rope, a cloth rope. We use a dart gun, more aggressive release where they can express that, a soft shield, a box bag that they can hit. And then the third category of toys is creative expression. And that would be all of your paints and finger paints and markers and paper and glue and feathers and all the clay, Play-Doh, all the creative sand is one of those. And that's, so we have the same toys, and in play therapy we have all the toys in the same place when the child enters the room. And if the toys are like their words, they need to know where to go to get their words. And children are most observant, mm-hmm. and they notice if you put anything in a different place. So the counselor gets the child and walks into the playroom and says to the child, Mary, this is our playroom, and in here you can play with the toys in a lot of the ways you'd like to. And the counselor then sits down and waits for the child to begin. And then the counselor is responsive to what the child does. That is kind of the way we begin. And one of the things I just said is you can play with the toys in a lot of the ways. And we have a specific strategy for setting limits if children need it, but we don't set limits until they're needed. Mm. Children don't walk in with a list of rules in this orientation. We only set a limit when it's needed. So you asked about our skills. Mm-hmm. There are a number of basic skills. I'll just tell you what they are. One skill we use is called tracking, and that's a skill that's almost a play-by-play, blow-by-blow, almost like a sportscaster. And what the counselor does there is simply focuses on what the child is doing and responds to the child in a way that you genuinely let the child know that you see what they're doing and that you accept what they're doing. So your tone of voice is one of acceptance. For example, you might say, you're stacking those. You're flying that around. We usually don't label. We usually don't never label the nouns. We don't say if the child has an airplane. We don't say you're flying the airplane around because the child can have something else in mind for what that toy is. So we let the child label the materials. And when the child does, we use those labels. But before the child does, we don't label it. So that's one skill that we use. The most probably important skill we use, though, is responding to feelings, just as we do when counseling with adults. We say you're feeling angry, you're feeling happy, you're feeling sad, you're feeling afraid. We really look at the child and try to think, what is that child experiencing right now? And we try to communicate that to the child in a way that they can understand, in language they can understand, which helps them know that we understand their world, which is what our ultimate goal in our relationship is. This whole theoretical model is about creating a relationship with the child, a relationship where they feel accepted and understood. So by responding to the feelings of the child, we let the child know that we understand what they're experiencing. Another category of responses is a category called responding to efforts. In this approach to children, we're not concerned with the product, because that would be being concerned more about the child's issues rather than the child. We're very concerned with the child, not the child's problem, in quotes unquote. We're concerned with the child. So we're very interested in the efforts the child makes with regard to his or her play in the playroom. So if you have a child who's working very hard, say, to put the dart in the dart gun, or very hard to draw a picture exactly like they want to, we say things to the child like, you're working very hard on that, you're putting a lot of effort into what you're doing, you're trying so hard, and we really respond to their efforts a lot. Another category of response to this, we return responsibility to the child. The playroom is a place where the child is in charge. The child leads and we follow. And many children come into the playroom and they will say to us, what's this? What can I do with this? How does this work? And how do I spell school? And our goal is to help the child assume responsibility for themselves, for it not to be about us, but for it to be about them. So in that case, we respond to the child in ways like, in here, you can decide, or you can choose that. So if the child picks up something and says, picks up a car and says, what's this? We say to them, in here, you can decide what that is. Or if they're doing something with it, you can say, it looks like you have a plan for that. We let them determine and let them make decisions for themselves. Because our belief is that by focusing on what the child is doing, by focusing on the child's feelings, by focusing on how hard a child is trying, by focusing on a child's ability to take responsibility, we teach them that they are good decision makers, that they are worthy people. We increase their self-esteem because we have belief that they can decide and that what they try to do is really important and that their feelings are very important. So our goals of helping children become stronger people, feel more competent, feel more capable, like themselves more, accept themselves more, not judge themselves, be good decision makers, are realized by the fact that that's the way we respond to them. Always in a really genuine way. We don't want to say, well, in here you can decide that. We want to say, well, in here you can decide. Because we want to let them know that we value very much their decision. Mm-hmm. And another whole category of responding is the category of limit setting. And many students are very interested in how to set limits, as are parents. And we have a... Let me tell you about that.
Sure.
Okay. It's a three-step limit setting model. It's called ACT, A-C-T. And the A is... We acknowledge the child's feelings, like, I know you want to shoot me with the gun. We acknowledge what they want or what they feel. I know you're mad at me. C is communicating the limit. We want to communicate the limit very clearly. And we want to communicate it in a very kind of special way. We say, but I am not for shooting. I know you're mad at me and want to shoot me with that dart gun, but I am not for shooting. We don't say, no, you're bad. We don't talk about the child's character. We talk about the materials. That's not what we do with that here. We teach them that. T is we target an alternative for them. But you can shoot the wall. So we tell them what to do with those emotions. And the idea is, if a child is angry, we're not going to take away their anger by stopping their behavior. But what we can do is channel their behavior, target it into an appropriate situation where it's okay for them to express those feelings and release and get out those feelings. So that's what we do with limit setting. There is a fourth step where we have them choose, but we don't do that until people... we've got to be very patient with children and let them work through it themselves. I read something the other day that Landis said. It was so good. He said, oh, it was oftentimes we need to set limits around children leaving the playroom because they don't want to leave. So that's an area where we have to set limits. And the idea is we really try to be very patient with children because the goal of limit setting is to help them have some internal controls and help them, give them a situation where they can decide themselves. So there's a situation where the child wouldn't leave the playroom, and Landreth was saying to the child, you know, I know you want to stay here, but it's time to leave the playroom. You need to go now. And the child was saying, no, no, no. And finally the child said, well, since you're not going to make me leave, I guess we'll just have to leave myself. And the child just got up and left the playroom. But Landreth was very patient with her and never made a demand on her. Well, you have to leave now, and if you don't, you know, you're going to be in big trouble or anything like that. Mm-hmm. No threats, nothing like that.
So this has been... just very interesting to hear about, and I can just tell from speaking with you your passion for this and your sincere belief of what a valid way this is a method of communicating and working with children with issues. What might be some of the guidelines for somebody to keep in mind as far as, like, is there like an ideal age group? Are there some issues that maybe don't work as well with this type of theoretical approach? Can it work in group versus individual?
Sure.
There are a bunch of things out there.
Okay. I can answer this. The ideal age for child-centered play therapy is 2.5 to 10. Although there's a theoretical activity therapy is used for middle school children, and play therapy has been used with adults. The difference is the set of toys that are recommended by Landreth for traditional play therapy would be for 2.5 to 10 because you want children to be verbal enough that you can understand them. So the lower age group. I have worked with children who are on the upper end of that age group and even a little bit older because if children have experienced a lot of problems, sometimes developmentally they're delayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could work with a 12-year-old who kind of emotionally, not cognitively, but emotionally, is more like a 10-year-old. Because
mm-hmm.
then the toys are going to be still of interest to them. Activity therapy, you grow up the toys a little bit, so you have more toys that would be like clay or even woodworking or different kinds of materials. But the way you respond to the child and your orientation to the child would be the same as traditional play therapy. In play therapy, we really focus on the person and not the problem. So in terms of diagnoses with the DSM-4, that's not going to be as prominent for us as focusing on the personhood of the child. So the child-centered play therapy has been known to be successful with a very wide range of problem areas. I think one of the most challenging things, though, for people who are considering doing play therapy is very similar to an email I got yesterday from a former student who had a list of 6 or 8 questions. And the questions went something like this. The child is very aggressive in the classroom, but when the child is in the playroom, the child is not aggressive at all. Or the child is experiencing a huge amount of anxiety at school. But when the child comes into the playroom, the child does not talk or act out that level of anxiety. That is the question that is often the problem, I think, for people thinking about doing play therapy. Because if they're not directing the child to specifically address the presenting problem, then I think many people are thinking, does this help? How does this help? And how do I know if this helps? And the answer to that is someone can come in with a presenting problem, and the idea is that there could be times in the playroom where you actually see that presenting problem play itself out. And I could give you an example of that if you wish. But oftentimes they don't. But then many times you also are hearing from the parents and you're hearing from the teachers and you're hearing that behavior improves. Even though in the playroom you're not seeing that precise behavior play out because you don't direct them to that. Other times, though, you can see a behavior played out very, very, very specifically. Would you like me to give an example of that? One example of that is I once had a child that was referred to the playroom. I'll just give why she was referred. She was referred to the playroom because she got up one night and painted the walls of her family's new apartment. She was 4.5 years old, and she took... I don't think it was paint, actually. I think it was magic marker. She took magic marker and marker over the wall of a brand new apartment. Now, for a 4.5-year-old to do that, a 4.5-year-old probably would know better than to do that, unlike a 2-year-old who might not know better than to do that. That was the presenting problem. Well, the very first time this child was in the playroom, she presented a scene in the dollhouse where everybody in the house was asleep, and she was up, in the kitchen cooking herself breakfast. So while that's not an exact parallel, you can really see that, again, the child was up in the middle of the night doing something on her own. In the same scenario, this was a scenario where the mother of this child was Latina, and the father of this child was African-American. And the father was in and out of the home. And the mom had other relationships during the time that the father was not in and out of the home. In the playroom on the very first session, we see the little girl having a mom, and we have dolls with a variety of skin tones. And what happened in that session was the girl switched out the father figure during that play session many, many times. She would take a darker shaded male figure and bring it into the family scene as she was acting out different things in the house. And then she would take that father figure out and bring in another man. Now, in our orientation, we would never say to the child, what is this representative of what you live your life? Because it could be or it could not be. But that's how you could see that situation. Mm-hmm. You also see a lot of achievement situations where the child will have the counselor be the student and the child will be the teacher. And you can see something back out that it might look similar to what's going on in the classroom. But you might not. It's also true that a child will just come in and play with toys. Let me give another example. One of the most popular toys that I've seen in the playroom are the handcuffs. And the child comes in, and the child can handcuff the counselor. The child can handcuff himself to the counselor. The child can just play with the handcuffs. If you see a child coming in developing a pattern of handcuffing the counselor every time, one of the things you might think, and a child is having issues of control and power in the classroom, perhaps the child is dealing with issues of power and control, and the way she's doing that is through the use of the handcuffs in the playroom. So it might not be directly visible, but our belief is that what the child is doing in the playroom is really, if we create the right environment, we create a situation where the child is able to do what the child needs to do to heal and grow and take care of different things in his or her life.
And so it sounds like, it sounds like there's a high level of symbolism, which is inherent, I guess, in play, but it's so that people going in looking for concrete, looking to see an exact reflection, like the first example you gave, maybe even most of the time might not be the case. It might be more of the symbolic, like coming in and working with the handcuffs, but really they're outside issues. And so then I guess that would lead me to another question for you, which is, given that, how does somebody working from this approach address questions maybe coming in either in the school setting from their teachers or from parents in the community setting saying, you know, you're just, my child leaves here and tells me about all the stuff that they did at play. How is that helping them address the things that I told you were wrong, or how is this going to help them with their behavior?
I think that's a great question, and we really get that question a whole lot. Before we see any child, a child who's under 10 years old, we really need to see, have a conference with the parents. And when we have a conference, and oftentimes with the teachers in the school, for sure, and when we talk with them, we ask specifically what the behaviors are that are issues for them and how they would like to see the child be different. We ask those very specific questions, and we really note what those are very carefully. I think play therapy does present a bit of a dilemma because children love play therapy. And when you go in a school to get the child out of the classroom, every child in the class wants to go with that. And it really can be a little bit of a tricky issue because the teacher can think, this child is really giving me a problem in the classroom. And here, the child gets to go to the playroom and have fun. Mm-hmm. What is that about? I'm going crazy. And yet the child loves it and comes back and is so happy. And how are you helping? So my thinking about that is, if we've got a child that has a problem and we create the right situation for them in the playroom for them to deal with the problem as they can deal with it in their own time frame, what we need to do is to note things that the child is working on. For example, I mentioned the handcuffs. I could say, you know, how is the child, you know, I can say to the parent and the teacher, it seems like the child is dealing with issues around power and control. Are you seeing this in the classroom? Are you seeing this in the home? Then in the playroom, you can see those issues change. And as you see them change, you go back and note what the teachers and the parents said they want to see change. And you ask them specifically, how are things going at home? How are things going in the classroom? Are you noting any changes in the child's behavior and how the child is? And oftentimes, the teachers will see things, and you will see those same changes in the playroom. I'll give you an example of that. I had a mom one time that really did not at all get a child-centered theoretical approach or a person-centered approach to counseling. And when I talked to her, to the mom, about her child coming into the playroom, she just could not get how I was going to help that child if I did not specifically address what the problem was the child was having and talk to the child about that problem and create some strategies for the child with that problem. And this was a fifth grade boy who was very, very large. He did not look like a 10-year-old who was little. He was probably 6 feet tall. He wore size 11 or 12 shoes. He was a big boy. And yet we had the same materials in the playroom. Well, I worked with that child really for a whole academic year. And I'll never forget the time let me tell you that child's behavior. That child's behavior in the playroom was that he would go to the very edge of me needing to set a limit, but he would always control his behavior and stop himself and never go there. I'll give you two examples with the sand. One is he would fill a teacup with sand, just overflowing with sand, and walk around the room with that sand. Now, he didn't know whether I would set a limit if he had spilled the sand or not, because I did not set a limit, because there was no reason to set a limit. But he would do that, and he never spilled the sand. Also, at that time, I had a large Tupperware container full of sand. It was a pretty small playroom. And that child would take one end of the Tupperware container and lift it up until the point that the sand was about to fall on the floor. He was about to pour all the sand on the floor, and he never poured the sand out on the floor. He just got to the edge, and he wanted to see, I'm sure he was testing me, he wanted to see what I was going to do, if I would stop him. He was testing himself, but he never did. So I try to meet with parents of young children every 3 weeks or so with a discussion with them about how are things going at home, what's seeing anything, just to touch base with them, because I need a really good relationship with parents to work with their children. So I was noting a theme when I was working with the child, and the theme I was noting was, this child kind of goes to the edge of the limit, but has some self-control. So this parent is really, I'm not going to tell the parent that, what the child is doing. It's really confidential, the way the child plays with the toys and what the child does. But I can, and I do share themes with the parent and with the teachers. And oftentimes, here's what happens. So I met with the mom, and she was like, very much doubting, how is this helping? You're not talking about the fact that he's acting out in the classroom. And I said to the mom, let me ask you something. A theme I'm noting is, with his play is that he takes things right to the edge, but right at the last minute, he just complies. So her face was just so surprised at that, and she said to me, I can't believe that you are, that you're saying that, because he does that with me every day. And she gave me all these examples. One example was getting off to school in the morning. He lollygags and lollygags, she said. He just puts things off and puts things off. But right at the last moment, you know, before I'm screaming my head off, lo and behold, he gets his shoes on and he gets into the car. He really doesn't go beyond that, or going to bed at night, or coming to the table to eat a meal, or turning off the TV set when the time's up. So she saw that theme exhibited in his play all the time. And I think that this is what we need to talk to the teachers and the parents about. It's about the theme. Another thing we talk to the, let me just say this, is the more for children there can be consistency in their lives, the more that the parents are like the counselor or like the teacher, the better that is for children. So as we have these meetings with the parents and with the teachers, one of the things we can do is we can share with them things that we do in the playroom that we believe are really good for children, not with instructions for them to go do that or for them to change their parenting style, but if we can help parents learn effective ways to set limits with their children that work, they can learn that and start incorporating that in their way of being. Or if we can share with parents how important it is to acknowledge how a child feels, how that helps the child feel loved, accepted, understood, the better that's going to be for the child. So during that time we meet with the parents, not only do we work with the parents on sharing with them themes, hearing from the parents how things are going, but we also have an opportunity to help share with parents some of the types of approaches we use with children, some of our ways of thinking about children, some of our attitudes about children. There's also a whole other, the second course I teach is a course in working with counselors to train them in terms of helping them lead groups of parents. And it has been called filial therapy for years, and now Landreth is calling it CPRT, Child Parent Relationship Training, where you have groups of parents and you train them in terms of having play sessions with your children. Because research has shown that parents learn the skills wonderfully, and parents do it, children change with parents. Parents love their kids and they can just do these play sessions at home, and counselors can work with the parents to help parents use those skills. Now, you can ask me another question about groups. Groups. Child-centered play therapy, Landreth calls a group two or more, because the group is non-structured. You don't have a structured group in child-centered play therapy. You don't want a whole lot of children in a group. But I did groups of two in a preschool several years ago, and we matched children in terms of what issues they were dealing with. Because in a preschool environment or in a school environment, a lot of what goes on in a classroom that can be troublesome for a child has to do with social interactions of the child with other children. So group child-centered play therapy, I think, is a really good idea. I think counselors need to make sure they're comfortable working with one child before they try to do it with two. Because with two children trying to keep up with what they're both doing in a more permissive way, it's pretty busy in a playroom. They can be pretty active.
I can imagine.
And they can, you have to set limits around them, how they talk or how they might be physical with each other.
Mm-hmm.
set limits with them in terms of interacting with each other. But I think you can use group, but you have, but it's not as easy as, I think the goals are realized very well with a small group, but it's really, you can't have a group with 6 or 8 kids doing that.
Yeah.
Although I did see one videotape with 2 counselors and triplets doing child centered play therapy, but it was wild with 5 people in the room, but it was really interesting.
Very interesting. I'm wondering, we kind of touched on some questions, and I think you gave a wonderful explanation about, you know, how, what words that you would use to communicate with the parents and the teachers about what is actually going on, and how the importance of us as counselors staying connected with them as we're working with the children. I'm wondering, from your experience of doing trainings and workshops with this and teaching it, are there any other questions that are frequently asked or other issues that you know that tend to be general that would be helpful for us to hear about now?
The most common concern is the concern that we've mentioned, and that is, if you don't see the child acting out something, if you don't direct the child specifically to the problem, how is that helpful, and how will I see that the child is changing? I think that is the most common thing. I think the most common concern in the workshops that I do is really about the theoretical base, where the belief in the child's ability to solve their own problem, the belief that the child will deal in his or her own way with the issues that he or she needs to deal with, I think it's very hard for some people to trust that, and to trust that a process with children where you're trusting that they can do that, I think it's very difficult. I think it's much easier. I think it's difficult with working with adults, too, in a person-centered model. I think it's a difficult theoretical model. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes as counselors, we're in a world that is about managed care and solution-focused and quick fixes and internet, and you do things fast. And child-centered play therapy, one of the things Landreth says is it takes a lot of slow to grow. We need to give children the patience. We need to give them a lot of patience and let them develop at their own rate. And he has a wonderful story he tells, and the story is about a bean sprout. And if the counselor is the soil, the perfect soil, the perfect sunlight, the perfect environment for that bean sprout to grow, and you have a little bean sprout that is just coming out of the ground and it's got its little neck hook, the question is, what do we do to that bean sprout if we take it, because we want it to grow faster, we want it to change faster, we want it to be big, and we pull up on it? What happens in that case is we break it. We pull it out of the ground, and it doesn't grow. So what we try to do is we try to be that soil and that picture, and we let that bean sprout grow in the time that it takes it to grow, and we trust that it will grow at its own rate. My own personal feeling about it with regard to this theoretical model is, if we only have a limited amount of time to be with a child, why not give that child the gift of accepting the child, trusting the child, allowing the child an opportunity to make choices, to make decisions, to focus on what the child has, how hard that child is working on being who that child is being, just accepting that child for who he or she is. Because I think that is what is life-giving to a child. And if you only have 1 hour with that child, or if you have 6 hours, or if you have a year, I think that what we give a child might be richer, in my way of thinking, than going in with some worksheets or a strategy where it might connect with where the child is, and it might not connect with the child, where the child is. That's just where I'm coming from. And I think these other approaches can be very, very effective, so I don't want to undermine them in any way. But I just also think that the hardest hurdle is to really believe in the process, and to really trust the theoretical underpinnings of what Carl Rogers, Virginia Atwine, and Gary Landreth believe.
And so even if there's, and that was going to be something I was going to ask about, was often we do have limitations put on how many times we can work with a family or how many times we can see that child, or in school setting, you know, only having open two or three times before having to refer them on. And so you would offer that by trusting in the process and trusting the theoretical underpinnings, as you said, that even one time with that child in a truly child-centered approach with them, it is worthwhile and valuable to them, and will help them. Will help them. We may never know how, but we'll help them in some way.
And I believe that with everything about me. There have been some people in my life that I've only spent 30 minutes with, and somehow they touched my soul in a way that I was a different person. And I think that's what a theoretical approach like this to a child does. It might not be that they articulate it. That's why we use toys, because these children cannot articulate what they're experiencing. They have a low level of conceptual development. They're concrete operations. So they're not going to come out and analyze what their experience was, but I think that experience can be life-changing for them. I think also you learn a huge amount about a child in a child-centered environment. If you have a child that comes in and is confident and goes and plays, and the more things, when you have a playroom, the more thing a child goes in and touches and interacts with, the healthier that child is. When you have a child that comes in and doesn't play with the toys, focuses on one particular toy, plays with that toy for the whole time, and has her back to you, you really know a lot about that child. When you have a child that comes in and says, "What's this? How do I play with this?" who doesn't have the confidence to move forward in an environment where you have created a huge amount of freedom, you learn a lot about that child, and you see huge changes in two or three sessions. In our micro-practicum sessions that we did here at UNCC last week, we have one child in three play sessions, and we have three of our students doing those three different play sessions and receiving supervision after each one. And you see the children emerge in that. And it was very, very interesting. In several of the rooms, what happened is in the first session, the child did go in and say, "What's this? Can I play with this? What do I do here?" You know, and the second session, that child is not doing that. The second session, the child just goes right in and immediately is trusting that this is a safe environment and is playing with the toy. Because it has been communicated, that's what you can do here. The same is true with limits. You can see children go in the first session and be very compliant, there was nothing happening where you need to set a limit. And then in the second session, you see children doing things where limits needed to be set. You know, pouring all of the sand out on the floor. You know, sticking a craft stick down the throat of the counselor. I mean, you know, there are things that don't happen at the beginning that do happen. So it is my belief that even with a limited amount of time, the best way to be with the child is the best way to be with the child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether you have one time with that child or whether you have 30 times with that child, it's the best way to be with the child. Because it's a way of being, it's a way of building relationships, and it is through that relationship that a child changes. It is not about the toys. The skills are skills that are designed to build relationships. It is about the relationship with the child. And it's only through that relationship that people are going to grow and change within this theoretical model. That's what we believe, that it's not the tools of the trade, it's the relationship with the counselor that creates the situation where children can grow and change.
This has been very interesting. And I'll say that I'm biased, partially because I'm agreeing with most of what you're saying as well, with some of the things that I use with my own work with kids too. I'm wondering maybe just some practical pieces as we start to maybe kind of wrap things up a little bit. You've talked about, I mean, it's apparent that the playroom is the core of where this interaction is happening. And so I'm wondering if you have any practical, maybe some tips for counselors that are out there that have limited space or that have a space that moves. You know, maybe they're in a different space every time, or they have to kind of keep their things with them, as far as how to still access those three main groups of toys that you would mention, and if you would mention those again. And
sure.
How would you do that?
Sure. you know, we have tote bag playrooms, and you just make sure that you have some of each category in your tote bag. I take it with me to everywhere. I just have a tote bag in my trunk, and I take it to conferences, I take it to classes. You just have to make sure there are recommended lists for a tote bag playroom, and I can provide you that list. But it's some of the real life, some of the aggressive release, and some of the creative. And you've got to have things you can carry. You're not going to be able to carry finger paint. Well, you could carry finger paint. You're not going to be able to carry paint pots so easily. But I have a miniature playhouse with dolls. You know, you can carry Play-Doh. You can do finger paint. And you have construction. I have a doctor's kit. I have category toys from each category.
Okay.
So a roving counselor can take the tote bag. If not, the toys. The toys are the access to the relationship. And the second thing is, you can use a corner of a room. You can use a closet. You can use any space. What you need is the right materials, number two, and the right relationship and orientation to the child, number one. Many counselors have a corner of their office where they have some shelves. You don't have to have the ideal playroom like we have here at UNCC with running water and a sandbox. You can take, sand is wonderful because it's so freeing. So you can have a Tupperware container with a good lid and stick it in your, or have a Tupperware container in your office that's a little bit bigger. And just have that corner. And then when you introduce the child to the playroom, you tell them that they'll be playing in that area. And when they leave, you set limits around that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not very hard to do because the toys are more entertaining than your dad's or your book. You know, the children enjoy it very, very much. Troubled children, you will set limits with, but you know, the space is probably the issue about the toys and the materials is going to be more about leaving them than about joining them, I think.
Okay.
That was a good question, though. Having a tote bag playroom is not hard to do, and it's wonderful.
And you had mentioned, Will, you have links. Well, I guess my next question would be, for anyone that's listening to this and thinking, wow, this would be a really useful way for me to work with clients, or I have a number of younger clients, or I've always been nervous about it, but maybe this would be a way for me to work with younger clients, what would be maybe the next steps for them if they wanted to get more information?
There are a lot of things I could mention. The first thing I would mention is to buy Gary Landreth's book, Play Therapy, The Art of the Relationship. I think that that book is an excellent book. It's easy to read, and it really provides the text for how to approach counseling in this way. There are lots of places to get education. Let me mention those. On a national level, there's an association called the Association for Play Therapy. And there is a registered play therapist credential. You can go on the website. I'll provide that information to you and look at that. Each state has its own association also. We have a North Carolina Association for Play Therapy. And there are trainings and conferences both at the state level and at the national level. Also, the Center for Play Therapy at North Texas, University of North Texas, is where Gary Landreth is. Mm-hmm. That's the largest training center in the country. And here at UNCC, we are beginning a Center for Play Therapy that will be a regional training center for folks in the, hopefully in the states, North Carolina and the surrounding states. There's also a Center for Play Therapy in Oregon, that is a new center. So centers for play therapy are kind of popping up.
Okay.
So I'll provide you the links for all of those resources.
Okay, that would be very helpful. I'm sure for our listeners. Well, Dr. Chris, I want to thank you for your time and talking with us today about this. I envision that this is going to be a tool that will only be more, that will only increase in usefulness, I think. Any other final thoughts that you'd like to leave with us? Or?
You know, I want to thank you so much for doing this. I just think that in counseling, there are a lot of people that are children. And I think that the more we can do to help those children and to talk about what all different approaches to working with children, many approaches. I think the better it is for the children and the lives of the children in our world. So thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You are very welcome. We wish everybody a good day.
Thank you.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Phyllis Post, a full professor in the Department of Counseling at University of North Carolina, Charlotte, regarding child-centered play therapy. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID. Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.